Jeff Bears, Reel 8.
Well, these Germans that we taken prisoner, they were, as I say in my diary, old chaps. In other words, they were about 40-odd, and they were a bit shaken and what have you. And Cadell, our patrol leader, I said before, he was a brilliant chap, said, look, Jeff, take Bruno and this prisoner and go down there. We don't want these people behind us in case we have to come back and they ambush us on the way back. Take Bruno down to this small market town. That's the only way to describe it. It's about 2 kilometres. And take him down there and see if we can get the rope these people in or dispose of them. This German prisoner, he said, oh, no, they won't want to fight anymore. They've had enough of the war. So we said, all right, we'll take it. So I said, come on, Bruno. Now, Bruno, walk about 50 yards behind us. If I get shot at, shoot the prisoner, and he's walking with me. So we walked off down this road, down towards this small market town, large village. And I've said before about the extraordinary sixth sense that you have about that which we all developed. And it was, by this time, it was gone dawn, early dawn, late dawn, whichever way we like to describe it. And there should have been sounds. There should have been sounds in a place like that, either chickens crowing or dogs barking or people moving about. There wasn't a sound, and I'm getting more and more apprehensive. So I said, called to Bruno to close up to make sure that he shot this prisoner in case I got shot. And we come into the centre of this village, market town, and there was what can only be described as a small town hall with double doors. Now, all the houses, I couldn't understand. I thought there's something funny here. All the houses were still shuttered up. Not a sound, not a dog barked, anything. So I got to this building. I said to the German prisoner, tell your friends to come out. And tell them that if they come out without thinking, we shan't kill them. And so he calls out this information. No reply, still a deathly hush. So I told him to shout again and tell him that he was in good hands, we hadn't shot him or his other friends, and if they didn't fire, we wouldn't kill them. Still no reply. The double doors of this building are still closed. So I thought, we've got a little bit of trouble here. We can't leave these Germans behind us. He said this said, and there might be more. So Bruno and I better smoke them out. So I called to Bruno to come up to the town hall steps, keep well out of the line of thing. And I said, Bruno, when I say three, we'll throw the German through the door. Thinking he'd be shot for ribbons. Well, we threw him through the door. The doors burst open. And he shot across an entrance, a lobby, and hit the wall the other side. And nobody fired. And all we could hear was this whimpering noise. It sticks very closely in my memory, this whimpering noise. And everywhere upstairs, there was some light now from this double door that was open in the lobby. And the staircase went up on the right-hand side. Well, downstairs, with the light that came from the double door, we could see where doors were, and we did the classic house clearance, stand to one side, open door, and see what happened, and peer in, and with a grenade in your hand, and a Tommy gun in the other, nothing happened. So we came to the conclusion, they must be upstairs. Now, upstairs, the staircase went up the right-hand side, and that was still immersed in darkness. So it then became hairy. It was then a question, they weren't going to give themselves up. We were assured they were there. So they had to be accounted for. So off we creep up the stairs, being as quiet as we can. We come to the first door on a sort of landing. And we open the door. And nothing happened. We went to the next door, and I stood to one side and yelled at them from Auskommen, and nothing happened. And it was all completely black up there. It was like a blind man stalking his enemies in the black. So I stepped swiftly into the room, and then is when the trouble started. A hand got me by the foot and brought me down, and another hand seized me by the throat. And then I start a terrific battle with this hand that's grasping me by the throat, and the chap that's got me by the foot won't let go. And then Bruno burst into the room, and either throws something through the shutters or does something so we get some light. And this was, I think, the one time my hair really stood on end. I had, in fact, been fighting a desperate battle with seven dead men. I would suppose they'd been dead from the early evening the previous night, because it was really rigor mortis. And their features and bodies were contorted, and the first one had seized my thing, and when I'd fallen forward and the chap had got hold of my throat, was another dead bloke with seizing me by the throat. Well, I was so upset by all this, and so was Bruno, that we didn't even bother to do our normal procedure of looting the bodies. In fact, we never touched the bodies except to turn them over with our foot to see whether they'd been shot. None of them had been shot. There were no marks of any exterior on them at all.
But how could they seize you if they were dead?
Because they were like this, all arched back and contorted in their death throes.
With their arms out?
Pardon?
With their arms out?
With their arms out like this in their death throes, and the rigor mortis is set in, and often does happen with rigor mortis, you have hands clenched. We came to the conclusion that they must have been poisoned, whether they took poison themselves, or whether, as I suspect, there was a traitor there who poisoned them. And I'll come to that part in a moment, because they were arched in all these things. I say I didn't even stop, and neither did we take the watches or any. We normally would have taken anything we could have got off the bodies. We'd have taken them for the loot, but we didn't. We cleared off. Bruno didn't like it very much, and neither did I. We brought the German up that we'd had prisoner, who was still whimpering downstairs again. We brought him up, and he said they were his friends. And all he kept on saying was, why? And so I suspect that he thought they'd poisoned themselves. So we go downstairs. I said, this is all of them? This is all of them, he said. Well, he wasn't right, because the time we got downstairs, the patrol had turned up, wondering what had happened to us, because we'd taken a longer time than they expected to go and sort out seven Germans. And when they turned up in their jeeps, then the Italian population all came teeming out. And the head man said, come and have a glass of wine in my house. And we all trooped in to have a quick glass of wine to celebrate the liberation of his village. And in that house was, sitting there drinking with them, was one more German. And they said, he's our friend. He's a communist. And so I always wondered whether he actually poisoned those chaps, or whether they took poison themselves, because the German prisoner I had, he couldn't understand Why? There were no bullet holes on them, no marks or anything. So I will suspect, and I still suspect, that the German communist, the deserter, that the Italians had with them, had poisoned him. So there we had our glass of wine and went back to the main road, and just about to start off, and there comes a little chap on a bicycle, an officer, and a German officer. So we join him with our little throng of prisoners, and he's one of our most fortunate captives, really. He was the paymaster coming round to pay all the local Germans. He's gone strapped to his wrist a briefcase with all their pay in. So Cadell said, "Well, look, Jeff, we're getting too much loot. It'd be better if, instead of all doing it individually, if we had one lot of loot. And will you take charge of the loot?" And so I said, "Yes." "Well, that means," I said, "everybody can get what they can off of it. But if they have more than one of anything, then let's put it all in this briefcase, and then we'll have a share out after the operations are over." Well, I had thousands and thousands of lira. I was bulging with money. And other chaps threw in the odd extra cameras and the odd and the extra watch. Because everybody had masses of watches and cameras. Because if it was the Russians that fought for the Germans, they were doing the same thing as we were doing, and they were looting everything they could. And it was nothing to take one of those prisoners and have four or five watches on his arm. So I officially took over the patrol of the loot. It came in useful in subsequent times, as when people went home, they often used to come up to me and say, "Have you got a watch we can take home, or have you got a camera we can take home, or something like this?" But that's by the way. So I then became official custodian of the loot. I then, complete with this briefcase, which I then became strapped to my wrist, and off we decided we would go. Well, as we decided we were going to move off towards Venice, we could hear a steady roar coming up the main road behind us. So we thought, "All right, let's get off the road and let's see what's going to happen. What's all this about?" So we hid ourselves. And lo and behold, there comes the full might of the 8th Army trundling up the road behind us. Tanks, self-propelled guns, infantry carriers, a lot. So we make ourselves known to them. And there comes one of the worst cases of betrayal that I ever met. And I would quite... I must admit... The major there that seemed to be in command of the forward element of it, I would have liked to have shot him. I did later on, when McCluskey threatened to shoot him, and I would always carry him as one of the most miserable types of liver-lilied British officers I've ever met. Anyway, he said to Cadell, and I was standing with Cadell when he said it. There's no disputing this. He said to Cadell, "Would we do a forward screen for him?" So Cadell said, "Well, look, we're going to bump into some major German rear guards before long. We're not really set up for doing a forward screen down the main road for the might of the 8th Army. You've got armoured cars, you've got everything here. We're just going to be sitting in the jeep, and the first time we will go into a German rear guard, they're going to shoot us to pieces." And he said, "Well, you people are so used to it, and if you could do that, you could probably save a heavy loss of tanks and infantry." So Cadell said, "I'm only prepared to do it," he said, "if we can get back up as soon as we bump into a major German rearguard." "Oh, yes, no trouble," said this British major. what we'll do, I'll give you two dispatch riders. We will be about half a mile behind you. And as soon as you run into trouble, the dispatch riders are to come back and will then immediately back you up with tanks and assault infantry. All right, so Cadell, that's okay. We don't mind doing a screen like that, but you do realize we're going to be have our hands full as soon as we do bump into this German rear guard. The German, as I've said before, was always a formidable soldier, whether he was advancing or retreating. Well, this was all set up. And I should think the British major, and later a British tank commander, must go down in the annals of two of the most cowardly blokes I ever saw in my life. So, while this was going on, two of these partisans said, well, we know the roads round here. We will guide you on there. When we come to Dollar, which was the next town we were coming to, just on the outskirts of Mestre, we can guide you through it. So, with Cadell leading and Don Galloway in the second jeep, I was in the last jeep with George Donnelly and Mac McLusky. And we set off. We had these two partisans draped over the rear seat. And we went into Dollar. As soon as we got into Dollar, all hell delight developed. Everybody shooting at one another from houses and windows and from the church belfry. Everybody shooting at one another. So we, the two partisans, as were off the back of the jeep like the bats out of hell, and ran down the road. I saw them get a little way down the road and they both went down. I don't know whether they were just lying down or just all killed. I never bothered to find out. But the two noble dispatch riders who were supposed to get back and get our support, they drove their wretched motorbikes straight into the ditch by the side of the road and set cowering in the bottom of the ditch and absolutely refused to get their motorbikes started or out of the ditch and ride back and get some backup for us. Well, we're getting cut to ribbons, and we're also cutting them to ribbons under the firepower of the six jeeps, as I told you, was absolutely colossal. And George Donnelly told them all about their ancestry and what useless people they were. And if they didn't get back, we were all going to die where we stood. And eventually he got one to stand up and try and start his motorbike. When he did start his motorbike, came out of the ditch with it and rode off towards the full might of the 8th Army, which we could see quite clearly, only about 600 yards at the most behind us down this road. And those people then, the tanks and the infantry, just stood there and broke their word completely. They did not advance an inch. They didn't even send a tank to come and give us any support. They just stood there and let us clear the village for them. In the course of which, I'm all very proud to have been with the whole patrol. Nobody turned their back. Cadell was superb, but he also bore out what I'd always said, that for close quarter combat, the 9mm weapon was no good, because he was caught with a burst of submachine gun fire and fell and lost his carbine as he fell. And then he charged forward. He'd been had two or three bullets in him, but then he then picked himself up and charged his house with a fighting knife. There was nothing else in his hand than his fighting knife. The people in the house surrendered to him, but it was a very gallant gesture. Spiff Rogers was shot dead. Don Galloway was shot twice, but he ran forward with a bazooka, not a pit, as somebody said in one of their books. We didn't have a pit, with a bazooka, and fired it from the hip and blew in the front doors of this house. I was having my own personal little duel with a machine gun in a church belfry, and I accounted for him. Top Brown was shot through the chest, but he told his partner to pop himself up in front of the gun, and he continued firing. And the other, there wasn't one chap, and they were, I suppose, over half of us were either wounded or dead, but there wasn't one chap who didn't carry on in the thing until we saw the Germans withdrawing out of the other side. I think they were probably all SS, but the German officer was an SS officer, so Don Galloway came past and he said, Bring out the prisoners, will you, Jeff, and cover our withdrawal. And I just had a laugh, so I used to see the Germans, about a dozen Germans running out and across the fields, the other side of the village, the town. And I brought out the prisoners. And with George Sondheim and Mac McCluskey. And we saw this British major. And he had the temerity. He said, "What's it?" So Don Galloway said, "We've cleared the village." And Cadell, we're making Cadell with his bullet holes as comfortable as possible. And so he said, "Right." He said, "Are you prepared? Will you carry on with the sweep?" And Don Galloway, with his own bullets in him, said, "No, we will not do any more." He said, "I'm ordering you to do." And so Don Galloway said, "You can order me as much as you like, you cowardly bastards." He said, "We wouldn't do anything for you, and we never will again," and we never did. And Cadell said, "Don't have anything to do. Get hold of Potsky, tell him what happened, and report to base. Don't have anything more to do with him." So the British major said, "Why won't you do the forward sweep for us?" And so Don Galloway said, "Because I haven't got, there are six jeeps, and I haven't got six unwounded drivers." And he said, "We can supply the drivers." And so Don Galloway said, "Well, look, you haven't got a man fit in this division to sit in the same jeeps with these men, and we will not do the forward sweep." And we never did. But this major nearly lost his life with me and McCluskey, because we'd gone on 12 prisoners behind the wall there. I don't know, it was a wall at the back of the house. And with the unwounded members of the patrol, I was collecting their loot off them. Rings, watches, money, anything you like. Well, one of them had the temerity to appeal to the officer. This is against the Geneva Convention. And so this German officer, he was a brave man. He said, "That's against the Geneva Convention." He spoke perfect English. "I refuse to allow you to take the valuables off these men." Well, I must say here that by this time I was second in command of the patrol, because George Sonley was the patrol corporal and I was the last corporal, the lance corporal. The patrol leader was wounded, Cadell was wounded, Don Galloway was wounded, and Spiff Rogers were dead, so that made me second in command of the patrol. And so I said, look, they have their lives, which I think is, if you give somebody their lives, anything they have is yours. I said, no, tell them to hand over these things or we shall take them off them. And he then appealed to this same major that had promised the support. He called out to him. The major came over, came in the war and said, what are we doing? And he said, this man is telling us to hand over all our valuables to these other soldiers, and that's against the Geneva Convention. And so this British major said, yes, it's against the Geneva Convention. And so I told him what he could do with the Geneva Convention, and he said, I'm ordering you not to do this. I said, you can order what you like. If they don't give us these things voluntarily, we're going to shoot the lot of them behind this wall. And he said, you're the silly devil, as if I cared about whether I shot him or not. He said, you didn't do that. And I said, but I can. McCluskey, put him up against the wall with the others. And the McCluskey was a wild Scot. And he cocked his Tommy gun and shoved it in this British major's ribs and said, stand with the others. Now I said to the German officer, your last chance. Do they hand over their belongings? And he looked at the British maiden and he nodded his head, and so they handed over their watches and their money and what have you. But I say this without regret. If you give anybody their life, anything you want of them, they owe you. So I don't give a damn about that. So by which time, the wireless operator got on to Potsky and he said, report back to HQ. What the leading tank of this brilliant division then came trundling back the road. Now, we cleared the perishing village, standing by our guns until we had cleaned it. And he came back again. He said, I've been fired on by a Panzerfaust, but I've fought him off. And I thought, what a load of rubbish these people are. A Panzerfaust was really, occasionally you met me. I didn't even know they existed then, but apparently they did exist, a more than one-shot Panzerfaust. Normally it was a one-shot weapon, and when that was gone, it was over. But I don't expect a tank to turn around and come back after being fired on once by a Panzerfaust. So I said to George Sondra, I said, come on, George, let's clear off out of this rubbish. And we went back and reported to Potsky, who then had a terrific party with the Germans in Chioggia, and they'd surrendered to our West Indian officer, Steve Walbridge. And they had a terrific party, and so we also had a party there then. But Potsky had one ambition. So his one ambition was to land in St. Mark's Square. So he said to our landing craft, which was commanded by a chap named Lieutenant Thomas, Brian Thomas. We always called him Peter, but apparently his real name was Brian. And he said, would you take